Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, yeah, A-Dream, in the building, shout out to Bree.
What up, Bree?
And we finna go in, look.
Yes, sir.
Look, we came to break down a few topics here. So if you got time, sit and acknowledge it. Positive, uplifting, and honest here. Keep your ears open and soaking all the words spoken. A couple of jokes to keep it fun, get your laugh on. And maybe a few pointers to get your cash on. See, Bree, she all about building. Straight up out the NY, Brooklyn in the building. All the way down to the southern states. West Coast on up to the Great Lakes. So you fragging echoes, so if you ain't fragile, through the net connection, we streaming you to Metro. So welcome to the life of Bree, breaking down in the mouth to the third degree.
This is the Bree life, what you live in life.
Welcome to the Bree life, how we live in life. From politics to the current events, economics to race, whether you're poor or you're rich.
This is the Bree life, what you live in life.
Welcome to the Bree life, how we live in life.
Hey, coming to you live and streaming to all four points of the globe. It's your girl, Brooklyn born and Crown Heights raised. Living life and breathing life. It's Bree, baby.
Peace and blessings. This is Bree, and you've reached the Bree Life Radio Show, where we provoke provocative dialogue to also promote peripheral thinking. Tonight, we're going to be doing just that with our discussion regarding child custody and support, friend or foe. It's actually an update show of which we had a two-part series back in April where I was joined with Michael McCormick, the executive director of the American Coalition of Fathers and Children, and also General Parker, who happens to be a friend of the Bree Life Radio Show, and he is the executive director of Illinois Fathers. This is a topic that we all have been touched by, whether it's been directly or indirectly, knowing a family member or a close friend who has been subject to the family court system. And as I've stated many times on the show, it's my opinion oftentimes that the family court system is broken regardless of what state that you live in and really needs some major reform. And that's what Michael McCormick and General Parker are going to come on our show tonight and discuss some of the tireless efforts that they've put into putting reform in place and hopefully getting some bills passed with regards to the way that custody issues are handled in the court system all over the country. But before we have that discussion, as we're waiting for our panelists to join us, I just want to let you know that Bree Life Radio is proud to announce that we have our first corporate sponsor, who happens to be Soraya's Designer Salon, located in my beloved neighborhood and community, Crown Heights. And they're located on 261 Brooklyn Avenue between Lincoln and St. John's Place. And I want to tell you, there are several. I mean, every hairstylist that has a chair there has their own special talents. Very talented group of young women, very positive. The environment has a positive vibe and is very organic. And I'm just honored that the owner, Soraya, was so generous to offer her support to the Bree Life Radio Show. So we just want to welcome Soraya's Designer Salon into the Bree Life family and say that we are ever so grateful for their contributions. So what we're going to do, we're going to take a commercial break, and when we return, we will be met with General Parker and Michael McCormick talking about child custody and child support, friend or foe. Stay tuned.
Green Life Radio is a grassroots radio show offering a voice to everyday people. It is without a doubt that this service is a pleasure for we at Green Life to provide. However, this service comes at a cost. For us to continue to provide this valuable outlet to the community, we need your support. Join us as we raise funds to keep Green Life Radio streaming while we provide assistance to Public School 161 in Brooklyn, New York. 15% of all funds raised will go towards providing school supplies to the students of this necessary and vital educational institution. You can find more information about our fundraiser on the web at brilife.evenbright.com. That's brilife.evenbright.com. You can always do better, but can you really be better? The mistake many people make is that they live a life trying to be better. They pursue degrees, physical fitness, group acceptance, well, relationships, trying to be better. The search for validation is draining and never ending. It is as elusive as a carrot outstretched before a horse. It's unattainable. Yet, we continue to run. We never accomplish enough. We never acquire enough.
It's never good enough.
We never try enough. And in our attempts to be better, we unwittingly tell ourselves we aren't enough. After all, who attempts to be better when they know they are enough? What's more than enough? Well, this is enough, and it's been Mark said it in under a minute.
It's the Breathe Life Show.
You gotta turn it on.
We're Breathe Life Show.
You gotta turn it on.
It's the Breathe Life Show.
You gotta turn it on. The Breathe Life, the Breathe Life. You gotta turn it on.
It's the Breathe Life Show.
You gotta turn it on.
We're Breathe Life Show.
You gotta turn it on.
It's the Breathe Life Show.
You gotta turn it on. The Breathe Life, the Breathe Life. You gotta turn it on.
Tune in Wednesday and Thursday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, for real talk about real life. Inhale and breathe light. It's the Breathe Life Radio Show on blogtalkradio.com/BRILIFE.
It's the Breathe Life Show.
And we're back. It's the Breathe Life Show. As our brother Mark in Houston, Texas said, I'm your girl Bree. And tonight we are discussing child custody and support, whether it be a friend or foe. And this is an update show. We're going to be joined in a few moments with, one, our very good friend and brother-at-arms, General Parker, who happens to be on the line right now. General, peace and blessings.
Well, how are you doing today, Britt?
I am blessed and highly favored. How are you?
Hey, every day we're on this side and we're breathing, you know, it's a blessing, so...
Right, that's right. Well, we know that we're also going to be joined with our other very good friend to the Breathe Life Radio Show, Michael McCormick, who is the executive director of the American Coalition of Fathers and Children. But if you could, General, while we're waiting for Mike, could you just please again reintroduce yourself or introduce yourself to people who are listening to us for the first time and tell our listening audience who you are and what your organization is all about?
Yeah, I am General Parker from Peoria, Illinois, and I'm the executive director of Illinois Fathers, and we are a group of non-custodial parents who fight for the right to make sure that children have the right to grow up with both parents in their life and have a healthy and positive relationship with both parents, mother and father. And we go around legislators, through the courts, and we try to educate them on the importance of their parent-child relationship and why it's so beneficial that their child grow up to be well-rounded by having that relationship with both the mother and their father in their life, so that we in society don't have to face all the ills that comes from all the pathologies the children end up with by not having that relationship with that missing parent.
And you're so right. I see that Mike is on the line right now, so we're going to bring him into the discussion because there's so much that we need to touch on tonight. Mike, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Bree. I'm here. And sorry I'm late.
Hi. How are you?
Nice to be talking to you again.
And welcome back.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Again, I apologize for being late. Just picking up the kids from a church-related activity and wasn't close to a phone.
That's okay. So now that I have both of you gentlemen on the line now, you could first, Mike, please introduce yourself to our listening audience. Tell our audience what your organization does. And then I want to jump right into, because I, you know, there are a lot of people, you, as you both know, this is a very tense topic, and it has touched someone directly or indirectly in our personal, that we share personal space and time with. So people are eager to listen to what you both have to say, as you both are pretty much leading experts on this issue. And I know when we were having our shows back in April, there was some major legislation that both of you were lobbying to get passed in the form of a bill for some custody issues. So as soon as you introduce yourself to our audience, I want to jump right in and discuss the updates that you have for us.
Oh, fantastic, fantastic. Well, I'm Mike McCormick, and I'm the executive director of an organization called the American Coalition for Fathers and Children. We've been around since 1996, and basically what we are is a shared parenting organization. We're working to make sure that whenever a divorce takes place or if children are born to unmarried parents, that those children have the opportunity to have a full relationship with both parents. And so we work to see that the laws and the courts understand that kids need a mom and a dad, even if mom and dad aren't living together under the same roof. And we've been doing that now for, 16, 17, 18 years, somewhere in that time frame. And I'm happy to report that the message seems to be getting out there. And look forward to talking about some of these legislative things that are going on, because there's been a lot of movement since we last spoke in April.
Okay. And since we're talking about shared parenting, I can speak about it because I'm currently in a shared parenting understanding with my ex. We have a 15-year-old son, and I can always share my personal experiences, good, bad, and indifferent. And I have to say in honesty that I've had more positive experiences than I've had negative. It wasn't easy, you know, when we first started, because in truth, regardless of how we felt about one another, we love our son immensely. So sometimes when you're passionate about your child or your children, you lose focus of your child or your children, and because you want to try to get as much time as you possibly can. So I'm going to jump in and say and ask you, Mike, do you think, is it your feeling that shared parenting really works? And then I guess the follow-up question to that, and it will be both to you in general, do you really feel that now with some of the legislation that you're trying to move and get passed, and our judges and even the additional court, the court system in terms of the other individuals that work in the family court, like the law guardian and the attorneys. Do you feel that they're starting to buy into the ideology of shared parenting? Because you could better tell us. I'm just going to make an assumption that shared parenting is sort of a new concept of the last maybe 5 to 10 years. So do you feel people are beginning to really come around to the way of thinking that, you know, shared parenting is the way to go?
I would say absolutely, and I think that it's really interesting that you know, you're right in terms of the legal concept or the idea that children of divorce need to have both parents fully engaged versus having one, you know, primary parent and one satellite or visitor parent is a relatively recent development over the last. You know, over the last 10 to 15 years, it's really grabbing a lot more attention and a lot more scrutiny. But, you know, if you think about it, we've had 40 years now of a large segment of our kids growing up in single-parent-headed household environments. And so we know the negative side of single-parent child rearing very well. And we can see the problems with that. And what there is there's a growing recognition that the idea of forcibly pushing a parent who wants to be a part of their kid's life away from the child has a very detrimental effect on the child. And what we have now, Bree, that we didn't have, let's say, 20, 25, even 15 years ago, is we have a growing body of research from the social scientists who are studying this issue that says that, yeah, we've been doing it all wrong. What we've been doing is we've been actually damaging our kids by taking away one of their parents. And as we give kids a full relationship with both parents, we're finding that we can really mitigate the negative effects of divorce on these kids just by keeping both parents engaged, even if the parents aren't living together. It's
General,
it's exciting what's going on. It's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. General, what would you have to add about this from your own personal and professional encounters?
Well, you know, when I look at it, sometimes I don't just look at it as executive director of Illinois Fathers or even just as a father who had his child taken away from him, you know, illegally. And I've had many different jobs, and lately I was an organizer, you know, and when you go through training in some of the different camps you go to, the one thing they teach you when you're doing your actions or you're meeting with people to try to make change and effect change is that, you know, power only respects equal and greater power, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So anytime you go up in the courtroom and you have a spouse who's a custodial parent and they feel that they have all the power, why would they want to change if they're holding all the cards? And they could care less about what you're going through, and sometimes I think they just try to deny what the child is going through. They're not going to change because they're holding all the cards. But with the laws that we're trying to get enacted, you know, it kind of puts things more on an even keel. And when a non-custodial parent can come into court and say, hey, they haven't been abiding by the order, and I haven't seen my child, and just like you would put me in jail for non-compliance of child support, I want the same thing done to them for non-compliance, you know, for visitation. And when they realize that that can happen to them, it starts to change attitudes, you know, and people start to turn the kids over like they're supposed to, and they quit talking ill of the other parent. And I think even if it's not for the kids' sake, it's sometimes for even their own sake, because a lot of them don't like to go to jail if they don't have to be fined or some of the other sanctions that may come down on them. So some people have changed willingly. Some people have been made to change by the laws that have been enacted recently. But, yeah, Mike's right. There's a change coming about. So I'm glad that I was a part of that.
Yeah, and Bree, I want to just kind of reinforce what General's saying here, and a real significant point that you brought up as well. You know, we've got to recognize, and citizens need to recognize, that there are a lot of people who are participating in the existing system that profit by keeping the system the way it is. And you mentioned guardian ad litems, and you mentioned, you know, just the legal profession itself. There's a term called jurisdiction.
Also, Mike, let us not forget that my favorite participant in the court, the forensic scientist.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's really interesting because what's happening, I mean, I saw this, I mean, let me just give you like a right now real-time example of this. We just had a situation where we received a report the other day that a bunch of folks who are involved in the court system, who actually make their living from the courts, you know, the custody evaluators, the forensic psychologists, the people who are, you know, I don't know, some people say this is just, you know, short of quackery, the idea that you can take two good parents and give them a bunch of tests and then figure out which one's the better parent when they both want to be with their kids. And there's nothing wrong with either one. I mean, that's really just nonsense to try and, you know,
Let us get that the cost to the court or the cost to one or both of the parents for a forensic psychologist averages $10,000 to $12,000.
Right. I mean, you know, so what happens is when these people are generating reports, as this particular group did, they call themselves the Family Law Advisory Committee, and they put together a report, and they sent it to all of these legislators, and their report said, well, it's not good for children to have both parents in their lives, and we need to keep with this best interest standard, and we need to keep picking a winning and a losing parent, and here's the research that says why we should do that. And we got a hold of that. You know, that came into our hands. We got a hold of it. And reading through it, what we saw was these folks who are making their living by keeping the system just the way it is were actually misrepresenting the data in the research reports that they were using to justify their positions. So we contacted the researchers, and we said, hey, did you realize that your research is being manipulated this way to actually support the idea that children don't need both parents? And these researchers are appalled. They're saying, we don't, that's not what our research says. Our research says that kids need, you know, a full measure of both of their good parents. Now, they may, you know, we may have to do some things if there's real high conflict cases, or we may have to do some things differently if there's domestic violence in the situation. But our research isn't saying that, you know, every kid out there in every case needs to have only one primary parent in their life. That's nonsense. And so, you know, it was very gratifying to me to see one of these researchers actually come back out and challenge this group of people who position themselves as being experts and say, hey, why are you misrepresenting the data of all of these researchers? And that's what's taking place now that I think is so vital within the professional community of people who practice in the area of family law, is that it's really getting to a point now where people are saying, no, you can't, you know, the professional social scientists are saying, one, you can't misrepresent our data. And secondly, the data is very clear about children's need for both parents, particularly when you're dealing with fit parents, that you know, what we've done has been problematic. So we're really happy to see things like, for instance, this research was used this year to train over 250 family court judges in Illinois on why
children... Oh, I'm delighted to hear that, because
yeah,
that was a question to throw to you.
Yeah, and that, you know, I mean, this is one of the areas where we're seeing improvement. So I'll give you an illustration. 250 family court judges in Illinois were trained this year on the importance of two-parent involvement in children's lives, on why 70 days a year is not enough time for the non-residential or non-custodial parent and the child to develop a full parent-child relationship and to bond the way they need to bond and why the courts need to change. And what's coming up now in Illinois, and General can speak to this very well, he's been right on the forefront of this, is now legislation has been introduced and will be reintroduced in the next session that says, hey, let's change our laws in Illinois so that each parent will get at least 35% time with their kids. And the difference between, you know, what we know from a social science perspective and a child development perspective is that the difference between having 127 overnights a year with one of your parents versus having 85 overnights, that's a world of difference. So I'm very pleased about the trend lines. We're seeing this in other parts of the country. I just had a report today about an upcoming case where, you know, one of these social scientists had testified in a custody case and not testified for mom or for dad. They just testified as to what the research says is best for children in general. And I was pleased to hear today that now the other family court judges in that area have all heard about this. And I think that a lot of what we have to do, you know, judges are educated all the time. And it really depends upon who's doing the education.
If I could interrupt you for a moment. That's exactly, because I want to make sure we stay on this point because it's real important, especially for our audience, because I've gotten a lot of calls and a lot of emails about this one topic about judges. Could you just, for our listeners, define or explain to our listeners that how judges come to be a family court judge, whether or not it's something that they sort of hone in on as a principle that they want to practice as a career once they finish law school, or are they appointed? Because there's a confusion about that amongst the general population that now finds themselves in family court. So if you could do that for us. And then after you complete that, then I want you to explain to our audience what a forensic psychologist is. Because when I've used that term with a lot of people, they're like, what the hell is a forensic psychologist? You know, so if you could just define those two bodies for us, so our listeners could have a full understanding, that'd be great.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's really interesting. There are a couple of ways judges actually get to be judges, and so that's why there is confusion about that, because it just depends on where you are. In some states, judges are elected. And so you go and you vote for judges in an election process, just like you vote for your legislators. And so judges will come up and they'll be, the public will have the opportunity to vote on who's going to be the judges. In other states, judges are actually appointed. And they can be appointed by the legislature, or they can be appointed, lower court judges can be appointed by Supreme Court judges, or the governor can make the judicial selections. And so what typically happens in that case is that a commission is formed, a judicial nominating commission is formed, and then that commission is tasked with going out and identifying qualified attorneys, individuals that they believe would make good judges, and then that commission will put forward a list of names to either the governor or to the legislature and say, here are the people that we think are qualified to fill positions on the bench, and they will be appointed to positions on the bench.
And now, are those qualifications based on their experience working in social services, working directly with children? What qualifies a judge to be a family court judge?
Okay, well, here's the thing. There are an awful lot of judges that are in family court that don't want to be in family court. And there are an awful lot of judges that when we typically see a judge that's been a family court judge, let's say for 10 years, you know, a lot of times we look at it and we go, I wonder if there's some ideology that's driving this person to want to stay on the family court bench. Because being a family court judge is one of the toughest assignments there is as a judge. Because imagine, every day, all you're hearing about is people's misery. and all you're hearing about is people, you know, trying to make the other person look bad. If you're in front of a judge on a family court issue, you're not typically there trying to go, well, you know, I'm a wonderful parent and so is the other parent. So these judges all day long, there's a very high burnout rate on family court judges, for family court judges. And a lot of times what will happen is that family court judges will be rotated on a six-month basis or on a you know, usually it's a six-month basis. And so you'll see changes in the family courts as the judges are rotated through, because there's a recognition that if you leave a judge in family court for years and years and years at a time, there's a real high likelihood of the judge burning out, or of the judge, of it just being a problematic situation. So once they're on the bench, oftentimes they're rotated. If they're on the bench and in family law exclusively for a long period of time, it's typically because that's where that judge wants to serve. We find a lot of judges that say, I'll do family court, but I want out of here as quickly as I can. And the other thing that's really unfortunate from our perspective, Bree, is that, you know, family court deals with the most precious and intimate aspects of an individual's life, and that's their relationship with their children. And unfortunately,
right,
what we see in courts around the country is that the most inexperienced judges are the ones that are oftentimes assigned to family court. That your senior judges say, I don't want to go anywhere near the family court. And what we see is the newly elected judges or the newly appointed judges, they're typically very early on in their careers assign their rotations in the family court, because a lot of judges just don't want that duty. And it's a real shame, because typically your least prepared, oftentimes your least prepared individuals are hearing these cases that impact people for decades plus. Now, having said that, there are also very, very good judges in the family courts. And it's really interesting, as we've seen over the last several years, more and more and more judges are awarding a greater amount of shared parenting, and things are changing.
Okay.
And it's a real question of educating them. But that's how they
right.
get there. They can be either elected. Oh. If they're appointed, they're often reconfirmed in an elective process after they fill their initial term. But there are several different ways that judges actually get to the bench. And then once they get to the bench, they can ask to be assigned to family court. Oftentimes they're assigned to family court, don't want to be there, but it's just the judges rotate assignments. Some judges will hear criminal cases. Some judges will hear contract disputes. Some judges will be in small claim court. Some will be in family court. And then every 6 months, they'll shift. And that's a big complaint we hear from people, too, you know, is that, gee, I've been in court for 10 years, and I've had five different judges over the last 10 years, and there's no continuity.
Right.
It's interesting. But
and then the next definition that I'd like for you to give to our audience, and then we're going to take our first caller, could you define what a forensic psychologist is and what their responsibilities, once being brought into family court, are supposed to be?
Well, for many people,
I know,
they would
feel the same way.
Yeah, you know, they would. I'm sitting here and I say, well, you know, let me give a one word definition of a forensic psychologist, and for many people, that word would be their worst nightmare. And then on the flip side of this, I mean, I think that there are many, you know, forensic psychologists that really, you know, that feel like that they're performing a good service, but they also derive, you know, a really good livelihood, basically picking and choosing who's going to be the parent and who's going to be the visitor. And what we find oftentimes, and this is an evolving forensic psychology, particularly in the area of custody and divorce, is an evolving profession where up to this point there haven't been the most rigorous guidelines for those professionals. And so a lot of times people would say, you know, all I got here was nothing more than this person's opinion. They didn't interview my side. They seem to be very biased right from the very beginning, and that's been a real problem in the area of the forensic evaluators is that where are their objective standards for conducting these evaluations? How is it that so much weight is given to these particular individuals by the court? And then they relish that position. And what we've seen is that in many cases, how do you do this, Bree? And here's the problem in the family court. If I'm in a forensic evaluator and a judge assigns me to a case, what the judge is basically saying is that I can't figure out which one of these parents ought to have custody of these kids because they both seem like pretty decent parents. So forensic evaluator, you go in there, you run all these psychological tests, you supposedly interview all these different people, you go through the process of spending time to get to know these folks, and then you come back and you tell me as the judge which one ought to be the custodian of the children. And so here's what happens from a forensic evaluator's perspective. They go through all of this, rigmarole, and they produce this report, and it basically recommends one of the parents, and then the other parent is left out in the cold. And there's nothing wrong in most cases with the other parent that's left out in the cold. But if you're a forensic evaluator and you don't recommend one parent get custody to the judge, you're not going to get many cases assigned to you because the judge assigned you the case to begin with because they couldn't make up their mind. So they're asking
I want to put you on pause for just a moment, Mike, because we got to bring this caller on because they're running late for a meeting, but they had something that they wanted to say. So we're going to bring this person on.
Hello?
Hi, Peace and Blessings. This is the Bree Life Radio Show. You're on with General Parker and Michael McCormick.
Am I on?
And... yes, and your question was, or you had a statement.
Well, I have more of a question about the. I have a situation where I'm in arrears, and I was just wondering what are some of my options as far as arrears goes, because I'm not making a lot of money, and I kind of, I'm at fault for falling behind, but I've gone to court to try to alleviate it, and they've never really given me a straight answer. I was just wondering, what are some options I have?
I would say that the first thing you want to do is stay current with your present obligation. If you've got the capacity to pay what you're currently ordered, pay that. And then anything that beyond that you can pay towards the arrears, just pay something towards the arrears. And continue to go back to them and say, look, we've got to get a clarification on this thing. We've got to get this order properly adjusted and modified. You're absolutely right. It can be very difficult to deal with them. The thing not to do is not to respond to them. You always need to respond to them, and you need to keep pressing them as well to get a resolution, even though it can be a very frustrating experience. Too many guys will be contacted by the Child Support Enforcement Agency and do nothing. And
oh,
in that, So, in that situation, you can end up with, significant amounts of arrearages by the time you get around to addressing it. And what we've found is that the Child Support Agencies, as long as you're trying to do something, then they'll tend to work with you. But it's when when people go underground or ignore them completely, that's when they start to really compound their issues and their problems. And so I would just say you're going to have to keep going through the process with them. It can be very, and unfortunately, I see a lot of guys in a situation where, it's 5 or 6 or 7 years since the child was born. They had no idea, they may have had no idea or no contact with the child for a long period of time or for the child's mother, and all of a sudden they're hit with a bill for $20,000 in back support and current support. There are limitations to what the Child Support Agency is allowed to take. They can, if you've got a current case, they're only allowed to garnish up to 50% of your wages. It's 65% if there's arrearages that are involved. Most of them recognize that nobody can afford to give up, 65% of their income. So if you're in touch with them, you should be able to get to a point where you've got a manageable order. Understand that every state has presumptively correct child support guidelines. So they're going to, you know, if you're, just as an illustration, if you're making $3,000 a month and they go in and they say, look, the guideline says that at $3,000 a month, your obligation is $500 a month, they're not going to be able to look at your case and typically say, you only have to pay $300. They can't, they don't have the authority to do that.
That's my next question, because I've been in the case for about 12 years, and I have a child, and since she was 2 years old, she's basically made a salary, and the percentage that they took is more than, because I'm in New York State, it was supposed to be 17.5, it was more like 25% for like two kids. And
for two kids.
I never understood, it's only one child, but they never did the 17. I got the little pamphlet that says how much it's supposed to take and all this, and it's always seemed like it's percentages more than what's supposed to be taken out. And just going by what you were saying about the judges being burned out, I'm like a clinical case, and having a judge have a hard on for me. I seem to have the same judge 9 years in a row, and she just not even looked at my paperwork or nothing. It was just like, okay, well, I mean, I've waited 5 hours to see a judge for 3 minutes.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, and this is the, you know, and this is the problem. But unfortunately, all roads lead back to, you know, lead back through the court. And just so you understand how the law works in this, and particularly with arrearages and those kinds of things, the state court judges, and this is what's important, is that whenever a guy thinks that there's an error in their support order, they need to get in and apply for a modification with the local child support agency, because by law, the judges are not allowed to do anything to remove arrearages or to modify arrearages earlier than the date that a petition was made for a modification. So, you know, we see guys that, you know, they lost their job or you know, they got injured or something like that, didn't have the income, didn't go in to do anything about it for 7 or 8 or 9 months, and by the time they got around and filed a petition to, you know, to do something about it, they were thousands of dollars behind. And when they got in front of the when they got in front of a hearing officer, the hearing officer said, well, you know, I can't do anything about that 9 months that you didn't come in. I can only do something from the date that you actually made an application to do something. Now, when you get in a situation like you are, with a judge that just doesn't want to hear it anymore, or a hearing officer, I feel for you, because that's a bad place to be. There's not a lot of recourse in those situations, and as I'm sure you're finding out, all it's going to cost you is more time and money to fix it. And oftentimes, you know, there seems to be a real attitude in the courts that they just want to wear you out to the point that you'll just go away and just pay. And
a lot of stuff said to me was off the record, and like, it was very confrontational, as far as you just come in there, you know, I kind of was a deer in headlights. So I was just like, wow, really? I mean,
yeah.
I had a judge basically tell me, go work at McDonald's.
Yeah, you hear that. I mean, this is the other problem with what goes on. You know, a guy will go out and he'll get a second job, and all of a sudden they want to count the second income into his income and then raise his order, when what he's done is he's gone out there and taken that second job to help pay off what he already owes, you know. This is a problem within the system that what's happening a lot of times is, and what we're having to run up against, is these child support systems and the child support agencies are making money off of this process. There are billions of dollars that flow through the system just in administrative fees and in incentives and bonus payments to the child support agencies from the federal government, and just taxpayer money that flows around these systems, that it doesn't benefit the system itself to necessarily do anything favorable for you. You know, this thing feeds off of, it feeds off of you being in the system. And so there's no incentive within the system to actually do anything to lessen the burden on you or to get you actually out of the system. You know, if there weren't 500 people standing down at the courthouse every day waiting to see a judge, there would be no justification for asking for another $50 million to build a new courthouse.
You're right.
And so this is a great part of the problem that we see here, and it translates itself and starts with separating a parent from their child. You know, as long as the parents are both raising the child, there's really no need to have a support order in place unless there's a huge difference in the incomes between the individuals. But if you keep both of them involved, what we've done is decrease the demand for the state services, and that costs the state money. So, yeah, it's crazy. We know what the right thing is to do for these kids, but we've actually built our legal processes around doing exactly the wrong thing because it generates revenue for these systems, and it's being generated at the expense of your family. And I like to tell people so they can really understand this is that parents are being criminalized, your children are being monetized, and your family has been terrorized by this system. You're being politicized, criminalized, monetized, and terrorized so that the system generates revenue. And I am appalled that we do that to families in this situation. There are so many different ways that we can handle this. And, you know, the interesting thing is, how much of a relationship do you have with your daughter? If you don't mind.
I haven't seen her since she was 2 years old walking in court.
Yeah, so
it's a volatile situation. I try to talk to some guys that's in a similar situation. It's just basically you go in there, you really can't afford an attorney. I mean, the most I've probably made is $30,000. You know, I'm 41. And I just feel like I've gone in there, no hiding. Okay, this is what I made. And it was just like, okay, well, you got to pay this. And then, like I said, I had a 2-year situation. I tried to go in ahead of time to say, look, I can't afford this, you know, this judge I had. I brought every piece of paperwork, everything. She went in there and said she needed more money, not one piece. And she actually makes maybe double the money I made.
Yeah.
It was just like, okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was getting to the point where I'd rather go on to jail, but then I found out if I go to jail, the clock's still ticking.
Yeah, and that's something, you know, and this is, yeah, I mean, man, you're talking about everything that is wrong with the system. And it started with separating you from your child, and it doesn't care whether or not you have a relationship with your flesh and blood. It's going to extract a pound of flesh from you in the form of dollars to pay for, you know, to pay for a child that you don't even have a relationship with. And this is what this is. I mean, people need to be jumping up and down about this situation, demanding that it change. Because, frankly, I can tell you that your daughter is at risk for all kinds of problems because she doesn't know her dad. And you're irreplaceable in the life of your child. And yet the system tends to just ignore that. I love talking to Bree because Bree's actually one of those people that, as a mother, has said, you know, well, maybe I wanted this. I recognized that this was actually better for our child, and I went the right way that was better for our child. But we have a system that will allow, or that will encourage, or that provides all the tools to a parent if they are intent on pushing the other parent away. All the tools exist in this system to be able to do that. And that's what's wrong. And, you know, the fact of the matter is there a visitation or an access order in place in your case?
No, I'm so locked in, sir. I would need another hour just to tell you.
Yeah, how that's all worked out.
Yeah, you need to put me as a case study.
Well, you know, I hear you on that one. Unfortunately, I get about a couple hundred case studies a day coming through the door. But that's it. I mean, this is the thing. You know, people don't understand the magnitude of this, right? I want to, you know, and man, I feel for you. I feel for you. I feel for your daughter, your situation. People need to understand that what you're experiencing. That every 6 seconds in this country, a kid loses a relationship with a parent in the family courts. This, over a million children a year are losing one of their parents in the family courts. This is the greatest unheard of or undiscussed or unspotlighted problem, social problem that we have in America today. And I'm not even talking about, I'm just talking about the kids whose parents get divorced. I'm not even talking yet about the parents, about the children who never even had one of their parents in their life, who were born without their dad. Because every child born without a wedlock, out of wedlock, by definition, is born without their father. And that's another million plus and 1.4 million kids a year. And so you're talking 2.5 million kids a year that are effectively losing a relationship with one of their parents. And we think that we are actually, that this system is actually working. It's not working at all. And that's why I'm excited to see that there's a recognition that it's not working. You know, and what we know for, like, guys in your situation, there's two things. That the most important, you know, if you want people to pay steady support, there's three things that have to happen. The first reason why people don't pay support, the top two reasons are, one, they don't have a relationship with their child, and the second one is that they're unemployed or underemployed. So they don't have the money to pay, or they're not seeing their kids. And what we know is that when people have stable employment, and when the orders are reasonable, and when they have a relationship with their child, compliance with child support orders goes through the roof. It's better than 90%. When you have those three components. But we have a court that says, we really don't care whether you have a relationship with your child or not. We really don't care whether or not your order today is reasonable for your circumstances. Why would, if you ask yourself logically, why would the courts allow a lot of arrearages to accumulate in your situation when you obviously didn't have the money to pay? Well, it's because somebody's generating some revenue somewhere as a result of those arrearages accumulating. Right? If we can lock a guy up for being in arrearages and he goes to jail, well, you know, the way the system is designed today, the system makes money whether you are paying regularly or whether you are sitting in jail. That's what I'm talking about. You've been monetized. You have been monetized by the system. Your children have been monetized. If you can pay, you've been monetized. If you can't pay, you've been monetized, and you will also be criminalized. This is what we're dealing with today, and this is the greatest social problem that we have in America today. This breakdown of the family unnecessarily, and how the system. Remember, we talked early on about jurigenic, that term jurigenic. The process of family law is having a greater negative impact on families than the problems the families come to court with originally to begin with.
Well, sir, I have to go make this money, so I gotta
I hear you, man. Okay. And I tell you what, let me just tell you that you're
very informative. I appreciate the outlet to talk.
Hold your head up and God bless you.
So I'm going to make sure that you get the information on both General's and Mike's organization, because you may need some further assistance, and they're great people in terms of resources and to be able to vent to. So I want to thank you for calling in, and we're going
to
continue on.
Go to our website, go to the bottom of the page where it says shared parenting resources, and there are three pieces on the bottom of that page that are absolutely free to you. One is a 168-page workbook that you can download that talks about the system and all these components, the problems you're having, and then there are two very focused papers, one on the family court system and one on the child support system. And you really need to understand these systems and what's driving them as you're navigating them. So that material is there on the website. It's absolutely free, and go pick it up.
All right, I will. Thank you.
You bet.
Well, as we continue on with the conversation, Mike, and General, This is a systemic problem. We talked about this before in our previous shows back in April. And I could just for the listening audience again, I love that, Mike. Can you please give us the four tithes? Because I thought that was brilliant.
Well, yeah. When you get into the family court system, your family is going to be terrorized. It's going to be politicized. It's going to be monetized. And if you can't afford what's going on, you're going to be criminalized. Mm-hmm. So those are the four things that that we see happen to families in the in the family court system. And and I want to ask everybody out there, hey, go to our Facebook page, acfc.org, and just like us, because we certainly like to more people that like us, the more it shows. And go to Illinois Fathers and do the same thing. We need people to like our page. We want to show folks that we're dealing with and in the political side of this and the legislative side that this is a real concern, and that there are there are a lot of citizens that really want to see change in this particular area.
Well, what I want to talk about now, because it's an idea that I had, and I've talked to General about this, but my feeling, because of my own personal experience with family court and many friends and family members of mine that are going through or have gone through similar things that I went through, as we all can agree, that's not the best place in the world to be. And because now that we have, because you've been so generous to give us the clear definition of how judges come to be family court judges, it's clear that this is not something that they went to school for. They didn't wake up one morning and say, I want to be a family court judge.
I'm going to hold that thought. Yeah, go ahead. I want you to know, you said that, and they don't go to school. What I want to do is I want to tell you how right you are about that. Hofstra University did a report called the FLEA report, and what it actually did was it looked at the education that attorneys receive in the area of family law as they're going through law school, and it came back and said, we teach people, we teach attorneys everything they need to know about how to win a case in family law, but we don't teach them a thing in the world about how important it is for a kid to have both parents in their life. We don't teach them anything about child development. We don't teach them anything about, about the psychology of children. We don't teach them anything about the stresses that people are under. Same thing with judges. And we're changing that now. But I just wanted to say, what you say about, gee, the education is exactly what the profession itself is saying, that these are real flaws, within the processes themselves.
So then it would be clear, both General and Mike, that the reform that needs to be taken is not, or that needs to take place, is not only in the family court system. We should also be lobbying to educators and
Absolutely.
That teach law, that teaches law Would that be your feeling also, General?
I think any attorney or aspiring attorney who hopes to get out into the field of jurisprudence and then have higher aspirations of becoming a judge, even if they just want to be an attorney, I think that one of the prerequisites would be that they take up some type of what am I looking for, Mike? Family, not really family law, but some type of courses that deal with the family
adolescence, child development,
right.
Those kinds of things. Just this is where we are pushing at this point, and we want to continue. I mean, the fact of the matter is that 250 judges were trained in Illinois through the continuing legal education programs, and most states require judges to have continuing education. What we're doing is we're developing, and we've been getting, you know, in Illinois, you know, this year was the one of the first ones that this has happened, where there has been significant formal education process to teach judges about what the research says is actually best for children in these situations, and that they can know. And it's really very interesting what's going on right now. There's a fellow named Bill Fabricius at Arizona State University who's one of the leading researchers who regularly is working and training judges out in the western part of the United States. Judge Lawrence up in Illinois was providing this type of education to the Illinois family law judges. We're seeing it happen in more and more places. We're supporting those efforts by making sure non-biased social science research is getting into the hands of the people running these training and education programs. But you're absolutely right. This is a huge need, and it needs to happen not only in the legal education area and in continuing education programs, because every attorney and every judge is required to have continuing legal education credits in order to keep up their professional licensing, and most professions have that. But we need to expand this into the community of social workers. Social workers need this type of training. I'll tell you, the most underutilized parenting resource in the United States today is the other parent. I mean, think about that. You know?
That's right.
We've got millions of parents in the United States today that want to be a part of their kids' lives, and standing between them and their children is a court order that says you can only see your kid every other weekend. That's barbaric.
Okay.
If you think about it, that's barbaric.
Well, let me ask you both about idea of further of mediation. We know that there are organizations such as CASA that play some type of mediation role in some family court systems throughout the country. I know in Maryland, CASA is present. I heard here in New York City, I don't know any place throughout the state, whether upstate, CASA is very present. But what do you feel about the idea of mediation? General or Mike, either one.
Go ahead, General. I've been yakking here, so you go ahead and chime in here.
Yeah, well, before I answer that, I want to get back to a couple other points. Mike had brought up earlier about in child support, where a judge is not allowed to modify any arrearages and stuff like that. What I wanted to, and I hope Mike will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the Bradley Amendment, Mike.
Yeah, it's Bradley Amendment. 1986 was when that was put into play. So, you know, we've got 25 years of 25-plus years of child support, child support bureaucracy development, and that amendment has been virtually untouched for the last 25-plus years.
Right.
It needs to be addressed. That is the Bradley Amendment, and that actually ties the state court judges' hands in terms of modifying arrearages, unless the arrearages are owed to the state, but that's a sidelight conversation there. But General, tell us what you think about mediation. I've got some real definite thoughts on mediation. I'm very interested in where
I'm getting there.
Okay.
but to get back to that about the arrearages, what I thought was so telling is that, you know, everybody just went through the worst economic crisis that we probably seen in our lifetime, you know, if you're like 70 and under. And what our government did was said, well, we got big banks who make billions upon billions, I mean hundreds of billions of dollars, okay? And these banks are just too big to fail, so they can't even pay their bills, so what we're going to do is we're going to give them money to keep them rolling and just absolve their debt. Now, these are banks who can't even keep up billion-dollar payments, and they make it hundreds of billions. But you got fathers out here, and Mike spoke about it earlier, who can't even keep up with the child support payments, okay? Majority of the guys who don't pay child support are the ones who make $10,000 less a year. Those are the ones who aren't paying, okay? That's the majority of them. It's not all of them. It's the majority of them. So when banks can't even pay their bills and fathers can't pay their bills, or even some mothers who are non-custodial parents and they're obligees instead of, or obligors to child support, we can absolve banks from making bad decisions and wrong decisions, but we can't absolve parents for trying to make it every day, and we can't absolve their debt. You know, that just befuddles me, you know. And the reason I keep going back to these things is because I'm going to make my point here. It's all about incentives, okay? And when you look at your prison system, they'd rather spend more money putting a juvenile in prison or sending a man to jail and incarcerating them and spending from $50,000 to $125,000 a year, depending on what institution they're in, to incarcerate these people rather than spending that time and that money to put them through college for $15,000 or $20,000 a year and making them productive citizens. And that's what I'm trying to get at, is the incentives here. And when you look at our family court system, and I'm pretty sure you'll make the correlation if that guy goes to Mike's website and he clicks on the family courts and child support and everything, how all these different organizations, how all these different positions, like your judges, your guardian ad litem, your social workers, and all these people, they don't want to correct the problem. Because, see, that means some of them might end up being out of work. So the more opportunity that they have to make the system dysfunctional, well, not the system, because the system is working just fine, but your family unit, your family system, and you keep coming back to court, then everything's all right for them. They don't have any incentive to want to fix it. But we take the money out of the equation, I guarantee you, you'll see the thing turn around almost overnight. Now, getting to the mediation, that, other than the other parent, I think that is one of the most underutilized tools that you have in your family court system. If you
That's
get
why I
kids,
said it. That's why I brought the question of mediation up, because that's what I was thinking, too.
So what do you think about it, Mike?
There's an old saying about mediation. And it's very true. In mediation, you never give up in mediation what you know you will win in litigation.
Right.
And that's a very limiting factor for the effectiveness of mediation. And what I would suggest is this, is that I am a big fan of mediation, but there are limits to the effectiveness of mediation if the state's statutory scheme and laws don't support the full engagement of both parents in a kid's life. For instance, if you go into a mediation session and the practice of the courts is just typically to give one parent every other weekend and the other parent 85% of the time, then why would you ever go into a mediation session and voluntarily agree to 50-50 parenting if you know that the likelihood of you having 85% parenting time is 90%? You just wouldn't give up, you know, all that time, unless you were doing it out of the best interest of your child, and a willingness to be magnanimous and do what's best for your child. But if you're actually like most, you know, many people are, they're angry when they go into family court and they're fighting. You know, they're being told you've got to fight the other person as much as you can because you might lose your child. And that the practice of the courts is that typically somebody does lose their child, and it does turn out to be an every other weekend situation. What you've got to have to make mediation most effective is you've got to have a legislative scheme that supports both parents' full involvement. That's what makes mediation effective. So,
well, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
May I ask a question? Because here's the thing. If you've ever been present for a litigation in landlord-tenant court, I don't know how it works in the D.C. metro area, Mike, and in Illinois where you are, General. But here in New York, if you're party to a landlord-tenant action, before your case will be called, you'll both the judge will make sure that both parties are present, and the first thing he'll say, "Have you talked to one another yet?" And let's say that both parties have not talked to each other yet. He insists before he even allows to have the case heard that you go outside and try to work out some type of arrangement. Why can't we somehow encourage the family court judges to do that in the presence of a mediation specialist and the guardian ad litem? That's what you call them. I call them law guardians. But can't you encourage them to all three or four people go outside and try to work it out before you stand in front of the judge? We know the bigger picture that if that's done, then, you know, over time, over a period of time, people may feel that their jobs are in jeopardy. But if the judge understands that the child or the children in question are really what's most important, wouldn't it be advantageous to have both parties, meaning both parents, non and custodial parents, foster some type of open up the lines of communication and understand that this communication is going to have to go on for a certain period of time until your children or your child is 18 years old.
Right.
You know, why not encourage goodwill between the parents that are going to have to be held to the words that an order composes? What's your feeling on that, Mike?
I agree with you. I think it would be great. I think that the problem that we have today, for instance, the state of Pennsylvania has mandatory mediation prior to, and every case has to go through mediation and conciliation before it actually is allowed to be into court and go in front of the judge. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, the couple sits down with a mediator. He says what he'd like. She says what she'd like. If they're far apart, the mediator makes a recommended order to the courts. And if you don't like the mediator's order, then you can go in front of the judge and present your custody case. The same thing is true in Illinois. Illinois has mandatory mediation, and the couple go in front of the mediator, and they say, "This is what I want. This is what I want." If they can't agree, the mediator, you know, recommends a temporary order, and then they have an opportunity to go in front of a judge and fight it out. The point is this: is that, and these are state-sponsored programs. The state pays for this. The taxpayers pay for this. The problem arises when you have mediators that say, okay, they become like your forensic evaluators. The judge wants us to tell the court who should have custody here and why we think they should have custody. And so what you end up in these mediations is that the law, the underlying law, doesn't support the full engagement. See, here's where mediation would be most – let me just shift gears. Here's how mediation would be most effective. If both parents came in front of the mediator and the mediator said to both parents that if you do not reach agreement on your own jointly as to what you want to do with your child, here's what the state says will happen. Each of you will have a minimum of 35% time with the children. So 70% of the time is already off the table. And if you want to go fight about the other 30%, then you're going to spend thousands upon thousands of dollars to fight about the other 30% of that time. But 70% of the time is already off the table. Each of you are going to get a minimum of 35% of the time with the kids. Now, I'm here to help you figure out, so you don't waste a bunch of money, what are we going to do with that other 30%? the easiest thing to do is to split that other 30% right down the middle, and your child has both of you for half time. But the law in our state, and this is exactly where this is exactly what the proposed legislation is in Illinois right now, the law in the state of Illinois, if this law is adopted, then a person will go into mediation, and the mediator will say, it is the law of this state that if you can't agree, as long as neither of you represent a danger to your children, and I don't think you do, you know, there's never been any kind of allegations and those types of things, then each of you is entitled to a minimum of 35% time with the children. So why don't we work out what's going to happen with that other 30% time and save your family all the money and the cost of an expensive legal battle? Where it exists now in mediation, the way, and why mediation breaks down, is because there's no requirement in the law for a minimum timeshare. And the standard order in family law today is basically an 80-20 split. And if one party goes in and knows that the standard is basically an 80-20 split, and they know that they're most likely to get that 80%, why are they going to give up anything more than that? That's what undermines family law. It's like collaborative law. Collaborative law is a beautiful thing, and it works really well when the people who are involved in the process are inclined to collaborate. But it doesn't work at all if you have one party that's just inclined to fight. And that's why I say the statutory scheme has to support mediation in the event that people are inclined to fight when they get in front of the mediator. If they're inclined to fight and the mediator doesn't have any tools to say, look, you can fight, but I'm telling you, the law says that each of you is going to get this, and so all you're fighting over is this little piece of the pie that's left. Is it really worth it? Then people are just going to continue to fight. And that's why it's so important to change the law. Now, I'm a fan of mediation because it gives a mediator an opportunity to educate the parents as to why, and I think mediators can do this if they will, educate the parents during that process as to why it's important for their children to have both, to have a relationship with both of them, a significant relationship, and can move them along in the process. But I will just tell you as well that there's a tremendous, it's like this. People say, hey, family law works just fine today because 90% of cases are settled by agreement. They're not settled in a trial in front of a judge. They're settled by agreement. But what you say, and they say, there's no reason to change the law because 90% of the people agree to every other weekend. But the people who are agreeing to that, by and large, are agreeing because they know that if they don't agree, it's going to cost them $25,000 or more to fight it out in a courtroom. And most people don't have it. And they know that even if they go to court and they spend the $25,000, they're likely to end up with the same thing every other weekend because there's nothing in the statute that says that we'll do it differently. I mean, right now in Illinois, and General Hull will tell you this, the statute in Illinois says, the current law says that children should have frequent and continuing contact with their parents, and that it is in the best interest of the children that the parents are able to have maximum involvement in the children's lives. And the legal profession in Illinois has defined maximum parental involvement as 80% for one parent and 20% for the other parent. That's legally what happens now. And so that's why I'm saying that if you really want mediation to be effective, you've got to give a mediator the capacity to go in and to say to that couple, it's better that we work it out here because our scheme in Illinois, I mean, wouldn't that be better if you actually even went in, forget about mediation, if you actually went to a lawyer and you sat down in front of the attorney and said, I want a divorce, tell me what the law says about what will happen with the kids, and the lawyer had to look at you and say, well, our law says that there's a preference here that each parent will have at least 35%, or that if the parents don't agree to their own parenting plan, there'll be an equal timeshare between the parents with the children of divorce. If an attorney actually had to tell a client that when they came in, we'd see a lot of this conflict eliminated immediately.
But the law doesn't say that today. It allows the fight to continue. So what I say is, let's have mediation, but let's have a statutory framework that gives teeth to the mediation.
Okay, so then let's talk about what you both are working on for future reform. What are areas that right now, and maybe your objectives for 2013 to try to get some reform on in terms of custody, and if there are any support reforms that you're currently working on? And I just want to hear from both of you on that.
Well, you know, General, do you want to talk about what's going on in Illinois there and what happened with the visitation law, the Steve Watkins bill, and how that passed, and what's coming up in terms of, you know, what came out of the Illinois Family Law Study Committee, and then I can talk about some of the things that have taken place in other areas. Is that a good way for us to break it out?
Well, sure. Well, I think you probably be a better expert on the Illinois Family Law Study Committee bill because you were a part of that. You made it happen. But I want to answer a brief question about why judges don't have a goodwill and look for goodwill and try to make the parents work it out. It's just like I was saying earlier, you know, the incentives, you know. What are the incentives for him to even want to do right, you know, because right now each state, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, each state collects dollar for dollar. For every dollar they collect in child support, they are reimbursed by the federal government. So if Illinois was able to collect $6 billion last year in child support, then they get a $6 billion check from the federal government. See? And if the courts were to give you 50-50 equally shared parenting time, then especially if they have similar incomes, no child support paid. If no child support paid, then they can't collect child support. If they can't collect child support, then they're not being reimbursed by the federal government. See? And there's no money paid to the guardians. There's no money paid to the judicial system for training or anything else. So, it's just like it is with domestic violence and the Violence Against Women Act. You know, prosecutors, police officers, all of them, they all get money because the incentives are there to arrest somebody. You know, they can care less if anything actually happens. They don't need evidence. They just show up, somebody makes a call, and they want to arrest somebody in most states. So, but getting back to what Illinois Fathers is doing here in Illinois and what we are looking forward to in this next legislative session starting in January, to update you, Bree, the Stephen Watkins Memorial Act, which was Senate Bill 3823, was signed into law on August 21st by Governor Pat Quinn. So it's now a law, and it's Public Act 97-1047. And it was the last minute thing. They didn't do a lot of hoopla, you know, or like he signed it under the radar. But what it does is it strengthens protections for parents when they face visitation interference by providing stronger sanctions, and we were hoping to keep it on par with child support enforcement. We didn't get everything that they have in child support enforcement, but we got a lot of it, you know. So parents who abuse visitation orders, they can now have their driver's license suspended. They can face fines, penalties, and in very extreme cases, they can even face some jail time. So we got that passing. So,
well, that is a wonderful thing because, as we know, General, that seems to be one of the biggest common problems that occurs. And, Mike, I'm sure you would agree that in once a visitation order has been put in place, that's one of the biggest complaints that I hear from friends of mine or friends of friends that are non-custodial parents, that they suffer with the having to communicate and go through a lot of drama in order to still have visitation with their child or children, even after the order has been
stamped by the judge.
And,
you mean people aren't just volunteering to care?
People aren't just volunteering to comply with their orders?
Oh, really?
You know,
oh,
you know,
no.
It reminds me of
But, you know, it's unfortunate. I mean, first of all, we know that the average family court, and you know, I'm going to throw some numbers out there. You both would probably know better, but I would assess, from my own personal experience, my family court situation went on for an entire year. But that's because so many things was thrown into it, you know, with these layers of bureaucracy. But let's say the average family court situation, what's the average length of time that just a basic family court action could go on for?
Minimal. Usually, if everything is just goes real smooth, from the day of filing until the final order, you're looking at about 6 months. Yeah, but if you can get agreement, if you can get, you know, if people are just willing to either take what they're going to get or they're going to, you know, they're just going to go along. But I'll tell you what, if you have a conflicted case, or you have somebody who just is not going to do, many judges I know, they actually end up growing up with the children of the family. We see these people back in here once or twice a year for, you know, 10, 12, 15 years. I mean, it just goes on. You know, and the judges will say this, you know, I've grown up with these people's kids, and it's the stupidest thing in the world. The judges don't like that. They actually want to see people get done and get, you know, and move on. And you know, the best custody orders in the world are the ones that are drawn up, signed, and then put in a drawer and never looked at again. And parents just say, we're just going to do what's best for our kids. You know, we went through this formality of the courts, but we want to be as far away from the court as we can. But you have situations where people end up, you know, actually in the courts for, I don't know. Generally, you know anybody that's actually been in the court for years and years and years trying to get access to their children?
Oh, boy.
You know, I might have to Google that one, Mike. Looky here. I just Googled that, man, and there's a big old picture of somebody on that note. Look like me.
this is the problem, let's take the state of Texas. All right, we'll take the state of Texas. You know how many family court actions there were in the state of Texas last year? Yeah, I don't know. I asked that rhetorically. Let me just tell people. There were over 600,000 court actions.
In the state of Texas? 600,000?
In the state of Texas alone. In 1 year, over 600,000 family court actions. I mean, that just, you know, this thing is huge, and people just don't realize it. You know, I don't know. I could go on. I guess I suppose I ought to one day go on and take a look at Illinois. You take a little state like, just take the smaller states. I mean, I see places like North Carolina. You know, North Carolina, you get 75,000 court cases a year, family court cases.
Since you're giving me statistics, would you happen to have any statistics on the state of New York? Because a lot of my listeners are New Yorkers, so I think they would be interested to know. If you have any statistics on New York.
You know what? Let me do this real quick. I'm actually sitting in front of my computer, so talk to General for a minute and a half, and I'll come back. But I do want to talk about good things that are going on, because good things are happening, and we want to give folks some hope as well. I mean, it's not all negative.
Absolutely.
And so we do want to talk about that, but I'm trying to.
I'm trying to do this and just take a look at this.
Since while you're doing that, General, I have a question for you. For your organization, Illinois Fathers, what are some of your objectives for 2013? I know that it's clear through our discussion tonight, in addition to the discussions we've had in the past, back in April, and just our offline conversations, that there's lots of reform to be done in the family court system. So I'm just wondering now, since, you know, both you and Mike and a lot of people who put tireless hours into advocating for the reform and the litigation as you got passed, what are some of your objectives for 2013?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Bree, because I was in Springfield all day today. Not so much lobbying, but I guess you can call it lobbying, but I was sitting down with a lot of the legislators that I deal with, and I'm looking forward to working with starting in January when they're sworn in or re-sworn in. And some of the things that we're hoping to have a change in next year, one of them is a bill that has sanctions for people who file false allegations of abuse, because we feel domestic abuse is too important of an issue, and that when you call police and court officials away to deal with only allegations of abuse or hurt or rape or anything like that, and you know nothing ever happened, and you just find yourself being mad or you're retaliating or something like that, you're taking away major resources, whether they're financial or whatever they may be. You can call the police over to your house and nothing's going on, and across town somebody's being murdered, and the police could have responded earlier and probably saved a life. So that's one of the things we're working on. There was a town up there, a county up in North Dakota, and they couldn't get the legislators to put it on the ballot for shared parenting. So what happened was a whole group of people went out and they put petitions in they got petitions on the ballot in every precinct where they had a polling place. And those people voted by a large margin to change the law and allow shared parenting to be part of the law up there in North Dakota in Wash County. So we're going to be working on that. That's part of some of the Family Law Study Committee bill. It's a big omnibus bill that deals with a lot of different bills, with shared parenting being one of them. Michael's very instrumental in getting that taken care of, and the 30% minimum time and a lot of other issues. So we're working on that shared parenting aspect. A bill regulating the guardian ad litem.
Can you please expand on that? Because I'm very interested in that.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, when I was through my issue, and my case is out of Missouri, and we went through a whole round of guardian ad litem and finally got one that seemed to be or appeared to be halfway decent. And I mean, this thing went on for months and months and months. And this guy just sat down finally and he told me, he said, General, you're doing all the right things. You got your child in early childhood. You take great care of him. You do this, you do that, you know. He said, but, you know, the other side is this way and that way. And you know, I don't know what to do because, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a therapist, family therapist, you know. And it struck me. I'm like, well, what makes you a guardian ad litem? He said, I'm just an attorney, you know. So we're working on making sure that they have some of the social counseling or some of the social education that Mike was talking about earlier, some of the social sciences that they can deal with issues like that, especially when it's geared to children and what's in child's best interest instead of what's in his best interest. And we're also working on making sure they regulate what the fee is that a guardian can obtain, you know. If a guardian is not qualified to deal with the social issues and the psychological issues that their child might go through, then, you know, what's the criteria for picking this person to be a guardian ad litem in the first place? Because the premise is that they're looking out for the child's best interest, right?
Right.
You can't be looking for the child's best interest if your only interest is making sure you get paid. So,
that's right.
Those are some of the things that we're working on. And Mike has been doing stuff all around the country. I mean, things are just popping up everywhere. And, you know, people are getting sick and tired, and they're saying, you know, it's time for a change. We're not going to keep putting up with this any longer, you know. This court system.
Well, I know here in New York, you definitely would have the support of non-custodial parents, because from what I'm hearing, this is just common practice of what happens in family court. And one thing, when people tell me that they're about to go through this process or they're thinking about going through this process, there's several things. I say, listen, I'm not a lawyer, so, you know, I'm just a person who's been through a lot of stuff. And the first thing that I would want you to think about is conceptualize that you're going to spend an average of a year. This is going to take about a year of your time and resources to do. So if you go this route. So, one, what is at risk if you walk on this path? You'll have a job that'll be placed in jeopardy, because if there are layers of problems, as Mike identified earlier, if there are dynamics that would require further observation or assessment, then that means other layers of bureaucracy, such as that forensic psychologist and the guardian ad litem, all these additional people are going to get involved in this case, which is going to require more time, because what happens with the forensic psychologist, as soon as the forensic psychologist, and this is what we didn't discuss, is as soon as a forensic psychologist is assigned to a family court case, what happens is that forensic psychologist meets with each parent on four separate occasions. So the mother meets with the parent, meets with the forensic psychologist four times. The father meets with the forensic psychologist four times. The child meets with the forensic psychologist one time, or children meets with the forensic psychologist alone one time. And then what happens is one of the four appointments that you have with that forensic psychologist is with your child or children. So that takes several weeks. That takes about 2 months of time.
I was going to say, so
that's just 2 months to meet with a forensic psychologist. Then your law guardian is supposed to meet with, and that happens here in New York City and Nassau and Suffolk County. I don't know much about upstate. Then the law guardian is supposed to, it doesn't always happen this way, but it's supposed to meet with that child on five separate occasions. So now you have all this time. So what I advise is that you have to find a way to come to an understanding with the non-custodial parent or with the custodial parent. And if you can't, then my next suggestion is find a mediator so that you can sit down and talk with them and have an unbiased opinion of how you're going to proceed. Because I'm not sure if CASA, if they actually are working in the family courts here in New York City. So you need a mediator. And then if you can come to an understanding, then write it down. Get it notarized. And if you really want to become a part of the system because you don't trust each other, then present it to the court and have it a part of the court record. The second thing I always suggest, or the third thing I always suggest, which should be the first consideration, if you feel that the both of you are on this path and you feel that you have grounds for wanting to go this route, then be the petitioner, because you do not want to be the respondent. The respondent has very little voice.
It's always better to be the accuser than the accused, huh?
That's right. So, it's not checkers, it's chess. So
Yeah. Go
in there, be in the petitioner, but also go in there with integrity and don't lie. Because the worst thing you want to do is make the respondent, who could be either the custodial or non-custodial parent, and you try to make them seem like a dread to society, and then the court finds out that you're doing this because maybe you want to avoid child support, or you're doing this strictly fueled on being upset about the demise of your relationship with that person. You do not want to be on that side of the table with all those negative dynamics. So, I mean, when I hear this, when people have come to me and say, "Oh, this is going on," that's the first thing I start telling them. Think about what this is going to cost you, aside from attorney fees, aside from the amount of time that's going to be spent away from work. Because if you're in a situation where you got to go to family court and they calling you to go to court every week or every other week, how long do you think it'll be before your employer pulls you in the office and has that conversation with you? Or if you're going to school and you're going to school full time, and then you're not keeping up with your coursework because you're spending all your time that you would be in school in court. I mean, there's so many variables to this. And then let us not forget the most important element in this whole process, and that is your child or your children. Oh, my God. I saw firsthand what it can do to a child. I've seen it in other people's lives. And I'm telling, and for anyone that's listening to the sound of my voice, if this is a path that you're already on or that you're considering putting your feet on, you're not just walking this path by yourself. You're dragging your child or your children with you. Please, please, please try to do something to promote open dialogue with the other parent. Because when you both were in that room making that child or children, it was okay. Everything was okay. Whatever went horribly wrong is over. Now you have to focus on your child or your children. Put them first. Put whatever is bothering you about the other person to the side, and please, please, please put your children first. So, Mike, you got some numbers for me? Because you know I love statistics.
Well, it just so happens that I was able to come up with a couple of numbers for you. It looks like the most recent report we have on the data out of New York is from 2010. And in the state of New York, there were in the entire state of New York for 2010, there were a little over 720,000 family court related filings.
Oh my goodness! Are you alluding to the fact, could we be the state that leads in family court proceedings on an annual basis?
Well, no, that won't be the case. But you'd be right up there in the top five. The number one state for family law filings in the United States is California. And it's just California has a population that's so much greater than any other states. You know,
right.
You've got the largest city in the country there in New York City, but actually in terms of the overall state populations, California is the top state population. Then it's Texas, and then I think it's Illinois or New York right after that, probably New York and then Illinois. So, you know, New York's the top five, but California is far and away Your top three, one again, Mike. Did you say Illinois before New York? Number three
no,
is either going to be New York or Illinois.
Before Illinois.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's your top five is going to be California number one, far and away. Texas number two, and then number three, New York, and then Illinois. I believe it's going to be Illinois. And then Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio. They're actually around the country. They have what's known as the top 10, and it's basically the top 10 most populous states. And they've expanded the top 10 to actually include 12 states now, because there's 12 states that stand above, you know, that stand out from all 50 states. Florida is one of them. But you know, Bree, here's what we've got. Out of that 720,000 filings, 279,000 of the cases involve child support. 205,000 of them involve custody and visitation. So,
how many of those cases are ACS related? Do you know that statistic?
Tell me what ACS is.
It's the Child Services Bureau.
Child Protective
Child
Services.
Child Protective Services. Yeah.
Statewide was 42,000 cases. In Child Protective Services. Yeah. I mean, it's just people don't understand how massive the, you know, and that's what we were talking about a little bit earlier. I mean, this is the largest social, to my mind, this is the largest social issue that's facing the country today that is under the radar. You know, there's no.
Well, we have a caller. Before we continue on, I just want to bring on this caller, and I want to remind my listeners that we'll probably be going into overtime. So, if you're currently listening to the sounds of our voices over the internet, please call into our call our show number, which is 424-220-1862. That number again is 424-220-1862. We're going to bring our next caller on. Peace and blessings. This is the Bree Life Radio Show.
Hi, peace and blessings, my sister. How are you? Peace and blessings, everyone. Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, hi. This is my brother Alvin. How are you?
I'm all right. And that's a lie,
good.
But I'm all
good,
right.
Alvin. Do you have a question for General or Michael?
Well, I noticed the thing that, you know, I didn't catch most of the show, but I know what the show is based upon. I guess I could pose a question. I'm not really too sure how to phrase it, but far as like, you know, I don't know what could you do to make sure that the money that you know, with child support is really being used towards your child? What steps
Pray
could
hard.
You take?
Pray hard, because there's no legal requirement that the money that you pay in child support be spent on your child. It is completely.
However, we are working on a bill here, Mike. One of the legislators brought up, so I'm going to try to get that reintroduced next year. The custodial parent give an accounting as to where the money went that they received in child support payments, and this is the same legislator that was concerned about welfare payments and stuff like that. So So they definitely looking at the fiscal aspect. They're not looking at it like angry dad, and they're just trying to go after the mom and stuff like that. They're actually concerned about if money is being given to you, you know, is that money being spent for what it was given to you for? So there's too many situations they find out that people pay their child support, and then the kid is still lacking for their physical needs. So,
I don't know
how far to go, but he's trying to reintroduce that.
Good. And there was a bill last year in Nebraska, the same thing. And, you know, what I would suggest is that this is an area where there needs to be more research done because it's a very common complaint that the money is not being spent on the children. It's being spent on the lifestyle of the custodial parent. And what we're seeing here is that as we think about it, many states now are actually using a debit card system to where when child support is paid by the non-custodial parent, it's actually applied directly to a debit card that's available to the custodial parent to go out and spend just like you use your bank card. So it's much easier now to actually track how that spending is going on. And it would be very interesting to actually run some pilot data programs to see and get a feel for just what is actually happening there. But Alvin has hit on one of the most common complaints that we hear regularly that the money is being spent on beer and cigarettes and not on clothing and food, and that's a shame that happens, but that is a pretty common complaint.
Well, thank you, Alvin, for your question.
Oh, no, thanks for the insight.
It's too late for you to come on the show.
because it's really important, because it's just, it's every relationship as far as a child is different. You know, it's all not the same. You know, it's not to put anybody out there, anything like that. It's just you want to, it's like you want to know, in certain cases. Because, I hear people talk about it all the time,
Yeah.
So, it has its good and its bad, like everything, But it's just something I always thought about, because it's not like, it's being watched or, nobody's like, really looking at what's happening or how the money is, especially if you're picking up your child. And,
right.
Your kid is with you and you see certain things, you might say, okay, what's going on here?
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing more frustrating.
Sort of like, for instance, if you find yourself paying $1,000 a month in child support, and when you pick your child or your children up, they're raggedy as all get out. Now, why is that? Why are the sneakers all run over and holes or worn out knees in the jeans and peasy hair? What's all that about?
Yeah.
Oh, and I'm paying $1,000 a month in child support. And see, in all fairness, as my listeners know, I don't take a biased perspective on any type of interaction between men and women. I'm going to call it as I see it. Now, and this is one of the reasons why women get such a bad rap about this child support, because there have been cases that have been proven where you'll have a non-custodial parent who happens to be a woman, and she's misusing the money for what men have told me. They say, oh, she's only getting her hair and her nails done and going shopping every week or every other week when the child support check comes in or that when that debit card is loaded up. And
That's a custodial parent, Marie, not a knock. So that's a custodial parent there.
I'm sorry, with the custodial parent. So, but this is coming from a non-custodial parent. So you want to just, I understand how one would feel a way, because when a non-custodial parent goes to pick up their child, they want to see that their children are living in healthy,
clean circumstances where they're being well cared for and well maintained. And that I guess that's what Alvin was trying to share with us. But, you know, to put a rest to it, yeah, there should be some type of way to track. And here's the thing with the debit card. When the card is loaded up, you're not forced to use that for food, for children's clothing, for, you know, it's a debit card. It gets loaded up. You put your PIN number in. $500 is on the card. You take $500 or $498 or $497 out because you're going to get charged a fee. And there's no way to track that.
It is a business.
And this has nothing to do with gender because, again, you know, just like domestic violence is not gender-specific, neither is a custodial, parenting situation. Both men and women are getting custody or residential custody of their children.
Yeah,
and I guess that's also another point that I wanted to make, Mike, in general, is that one of the reasons why sometimes a parent is motivated to push for shared custody is because they want to avoid having to pay child support. And we know this to be the case.
By that same token, some parents push to be the custodial parent because they want to be the one to get child support.
Oh, absolutely. That was the next flip side that I was going to say. Not only do they want to avoid it, there are some custodial parents or some parents that want to push to be custodial parents or to get that residential custody in order to gain child support.
Yeah.
And what do you think are some fail safes that could be put in place to, you know, for the judges to be able to see through these tactics?
I it's going to be very difficult because, like you say, Bria, an individual can walk in and have $500 on a debit card and take out $495 in cash, and you never know exactly how it's being spent. But what you can do is you can require, you know, like General was saying, some general accounting, you know, for how the money was spent on an annual basis, supported by receipt. You can actually track the debit cards. I've got a friend out in Ohio who happens to, you know, work with some folks who do a lot of transaction processing, and they say, yeah, they regularly see those child support cards, debit cards being used in convenience store to purchase alcohol and cigarettes. They see them being used at casinos for gambling, those kinds of things. And I tell you what, I've just been looking a little bit more at this report, this annual report on the courts in New York, and I wanted to address specifically when you talk about how does somebody get to be a family court judge. And how that can be confusing. Here it is for New York City. It says family court judges in New York City are appointed to 10-year terms by the mayor. And then family court judges serving outside of New York City are elected to 10-year terms. So, you know, if you're in New York, the mayor gets to assign the judges. If you're outside of New York, the judges are elected by the citizens. The performance standard for family court cases is disposition within 180 days of commencement of the proceeding, and 92% of dispositions were reached within that standard. So typically it's going to take 6 months to get through the courts. But, you know, what we're talking about here is that it can take you 6 months to get your initial case done, but then people come back over and over and over again. And so, you know, every time you start a new action, you know, you've started a new time period ticking on on getting something, you know, on getting your case taken care of. But that is kind of interesting. And let me just tell you, you know, what you can see here is that, for instance, in New York City, the family court judges are appointed to 10-year terms by the mayor. So inside the mayor's office, or at some point, there's going to be a commission that is charged with making recommendations to the governor or to the mayor for the family court judge appointments. So look at how politicized that process can become. If you can control the commission, then you can essentially control who ends up on the family courts. And that's problematic. You know, if I can stack a commission with people full of people who believe in shared parenting, we'd have great courts. But if I could stack, by a similar token, if I can stack a commission full of commissioners that believe that, you know, children should primarily be raised by mothers and fathers should pay child support, then we're going to end up in a situation where 85% of the time, custody of children will be awarded to the mothers, and the fathers will be given the child support bill. So you see how highly politicized that process can become and how subject to corruptive influences it can become. And really, citizens need to be involved in that process. It would be very interesting to take a look at who is and what body is responsible for making recommendations to the governor for appointments to the family courts. Incredible amount of power there. And you know how the borough section works up in, you know, works up in New York City. I mean, you've got, you know, political machineries that control what happens in the different boroughs. And it's the same thing for
borough presidents.
Exactly. And they control the courts there. You know, so anyway, I don't want to go down that path, but I just thought some interesting things out of this particular report.
Here's an idea, and I don't know if it's one that's been considered, maybe not, but I'm assuming that child support, that every child support case has to go through some filtering process of, If you're receiving child support, I guess for like every 2 years or something like that, you get a cost of living raise or whatever. Why not insist that a custodial parent, when their case is being reviewed for an adjustment, that they have to come in and bring receipts for the last 2 years to show how they've cared for their child or children to see if they even warrant any additional adjustment. Because what I'm hearing is that when a non-custodial parent's salary, let's say we have a woman who's a non-custodial parent, and her salary goes up from $125,000 to $200,000 a year. So, and she's having to pay 17% or 18%. Now, just because her income raises, does that mean that custodial parent is entitled to more money because she's earning more money? But what would sanction that? So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that, gentlemen?
Well, the child support system is founded on a very faulty economic premise. And the economic premise that underwrites and undergirds the current child support system is that the standard of living of the child should not be different in a divorced environment than it is in a married environment. So that premise completely disregards the fact that where the income was available inside one intact home previously, now two homes have to be supported on the same level of income that used to support one home. And it defies economic logic to say that you can support two homes at the same
on one family, income.
at the same standard that was that used to be supported, that used to support one home. You know, mm-hmm. and it just is impossible to do that. So what we end up with is we end up with situations where the custodial parent, we call it, you know, we call it the castle and the shack result. You have one family that lives in a castle, and you have one that lives in a shack. And one of the things we commonly see with non-custodial parents is that they end up moving back home with their friends or with their family, because between the child support that they're paying and maybe, you know, spousal support if they're paying that, they can't afford to live on their own anymore. And that's the faulty economic basis that's at play in the establishment of these guidelines to begin with. And so rather than creating an effect where, you know, a kid is going to live, you know, in a castle with one parent and in a shack with the other, why don't we create a situation where the kid's actually going to be able to live in two condos, you know, and recognize the economic reality of creating two homes out of what previously was one home. And yet the guy,
now,
you know.
Now, let me ask you something, because this is not an area that I am familiar with, because of my set of circumstances with my ex, we agreed to share parenting, and we also agreed that there would be no child support. So I'm not familiar with the whole process. But let's say I was the custodial parent, and I had a non-custodial parent, and wouldn't my salary or income at all be considered into the formula, or is it not?
It depends on the state where you are. There are states that, for instance, that's one of the things that's looking to be changed in Illinois. Illinois is what we call a percent of obligor income state, and so the mm-hmm. only income that is considered when determining who pays child support is the income of the non-custodial parent. Other states use a model called the income shares model, where the incomes of both parents are considered in developing the child support amount that will be paid between, you know, between the parents. And there are right now, I think, only 10 states left in the nation that actually use the percent of obligor income model. And I believe New York is one of those states. I don't think New York is actually using both parents' income. I could be mistaken about that. Don't quote me on it. But with what's mm-hmm. happened, where people are saying, you know, they're only, your caller said they're only supposed to take 17.5% of my income, 17.5% of my income. That to me says, oh, you know, they're looking at just the obligor's income, not the not parents' income, because that's what you see in Illinois. It's in general, isn't it like 17.5% for one child, 22% for two children, 26 for three, and you know it goes up from there. And Illinois just considers the non-custodial parents' income, but that's one of the things that causes conflict, Bree, is that people fight because they don't want to end up being the non-custodial parent. Because they're the only one that's going to have, it's only going to be their income that's going to be considered in that equation. So this is part
right.
of where children are being turned into trophies that parents fight over, rather than just retaining the relationship, both parents retaining a full relationship with both children. And the stakes become very high. You know, we have states where it's the shared income model, but there's a cliff. So let's say that you're the non-custodial parent, and let's say the cliff is at, 25% time. So if you have more than 25% time with the child, you'll pay a little less in child support. So what we see in those states that because you would pay a little less in child support to recognize the expenses that you incur when the child is with you, non-custodial parents never get more than 24.9% of the time. Because the judges don't want less money than going to the other parent in child support. So you can never get more than 24% time with your kid because of that cliff.
So
for
clarity, because I just want to make sure I fully understand, the time that you're being given is not being calculated
in the formula for child support?
That's correct. I mean, you know, there's a guideline. Let's say, you know, let me just look at Ohio is looking at its child support guidelines right now. And the Ohio child support guidelines say, you know, the non-custodial parent at this level of income will pay this amount of money per month. But the guideline is constructed in such a way that there is no recognition and no adjustment to recognize that the non-custodial parent actually incurs expenses when the child is with that parent. So, for instance, in Ohio, you can actually have 50% of your 50% time with the children, but under the child support guidelines, pay 100% of the amount of child support to the other parent. So in Ohio, if you have 1% visitation with your child, you're paying the exact same amount of child support to the other parent as if you have 50% access to the child. That makes no sense. That means...
No, it doesn't
child
seem
support
to make a lot of sense.
No, child support is supposed to follow... It's supposed to be for the child. But what we're doing is we're saying, okay, non-custodial parent, you pay 100% of the child support to the other parent, and then during the time that the child is with you, it's like you have no cost associated with having the child with you. And we see that all the time. We see child support awards that are so great from one parent to the other parent that when the child goes to stay with the non-custodial parent doesn't have any money left to take care of the child in order to do anything with.
Wow.
It's amazing what happens.
Barry, is it well? It's
there you go telling my business again, Mike.
What's that?
There you go telling my business again.
Well, it's not just you, General. I mean, you know, it's pretty uniform. And this is, you know, the crazy thing about it is, I mean, it comes right back to, you know, think about it. That's the monetization of your children by the system. You know, your relationship has been monetized. And you know, who are these people that think that they should come in and say, as a parent, these aren't their children, these are my children. Who is this
right.
Who is this stranger coming into my life saying that you can only see your own flesh and blood for 48 hours out of every 14 days? Who are you? Who are these people that would have the arrogance to do that? And who are we as parents to actually let them get away with it? And just go quietly into the night and say, okay, you know, you can take my child, and okay. It is astounding to me. Yet what ends up happening is that you end up suing the other parent of your child all the time if you're being denied access to your child. And look at the damage.
Well, you know what? I think that's a perfect segue to how I want to end the show, because we have something that has recently happened over the Thanksgiving holiday in pop news, and that was Halle Berry, her current fiancé, getting into a physical altercation with her ex-fiancé, who is the father of her daughter, and this got to be a very physical situation where now there's orders of protection flying all over the place. And I don't know if either one of you gentlemen have had the opportunity to, you know, familiarize yourself with this case. But if you have, I mean, could you both share with me what your feelings about this situation? Because this is a common thing that happens, especially when you're talking about being given access to your child.
Halle Berry's...
Especially supported by the court.
Yeah, Halle Berry's, you know, French boyfriend or whatever this guy is, he needs to understand that he's not the father of the child. And I can't understand for the life of me why men get so stupidly involved in trying to get in the way of the relationship between the actual biological parents of the children. And this is just the dumbest thing in the world. I mean, I think this guy's on the one hand is you know, trying to be, you know, this fella who had this child with Halle Berry has tried over and over and over again. If you look at the course of the history of that case, what he has basically said is, leave me alone during my time with my child so that I can raise my child the way I see fit, and I'm not going to bother you, Halle Berry, during your time with the child to raise the child as you see fit. You don't tell me how to raise my child. I won't tell you how to raise your child. It's our child, and we should work together. But what this fellow has had to deal with in order to be able to remain a father to his daughter has been incredible. And now you've got this third wheel along here that says, oh, let's all move to France and just cut dad out of the kid's life. I mean, I am astounded that this situation continues the way it continues there. And frankly, you know, I just think that, well, I think it's that situation demonstrates to me the height of the height of parents not putting their children first, and it also demonstrates how the legal system gives you every tool in the world to fight with if you're determined to fight. But what I see is, you know, if this fella Guy, whatever his last name is, the father of the child, if he would have just ridden off into the sunset, then you know, none of this would be going on. But he actually has said, that's my child too, and I don't need to ride off into the sunset. Why does she have any greater right to the child than he does? And she really shouldn't, and she doesn't. And the same thing could be said in the reverse. Why would he have any greater right to the child than she does? You know, if we want to talk about living in a society where there's equality, then we can't be hypocritical about it in this particular area, and especially when the research is telling us today that little girl needs both of her parents. You know, and it's very evident that if that child was given to Halle Berry, she would have no place in, you know, she wouldn't allow the father to be a part of the child's life. It seems very evident to me. I don't know. I don't know everything that's going on about, you know, the altercations between the, you know, between the biological father and her fiancé. But what I would say is that, you know, it's very difficult. I'm telling you, I live in a blended family. Those are difficult situations because and how hard is it? I mean, General, you know, speak to the situation. It's very difficult for a dad to see his child being raised by, you know, here's the situation that you have as a stepdad. All right, you sit here and you're as a stepdad and you go, why am I good enough to raise this other guy's kids, but I'm not allowed to be with my own? Nobody thinks I'm a danger to somebody else's kids, and I raise them, but I'm not allowed to raise my own kid. What sense is that? You know, where's the what possible sense could that be? Could that make? And yet, that's the reality for tens of millions of children in this country. 85% of the step parents in this country are stepfathers that are living with living with other children on a day in and day out basis. So you've got all these men in this country that are raising another guy's kids that by court order are limited in the ability to spend and have a relationship with their own children. It's creating chaos. You know.
Well, General, why don't you speak to that? What was your feeling when you saw this in the news? And, you know, just share your thoughts.
You know, I didn't really see it in the news, but I did see a brief article about it, so it didn't give a lot of specifics. But usually when that happens, it's because that the central person in that equation, which would be Halle, doesn't set boundaries, okay? You know, if she had made it clear to whoever she's involved with now, you know, what the parameters are, especially when it comes to her child and then her child's dad, and also as far as when he comes over and picks up his child, I had a temporary order in place once I finally got back to see my child, which happened in the last 2 to 3 months, and the guardian put in place. And I told her, I don't even want to go to her house, you know. But they try to make things so easy for, so this court is really biased, and this judge has a mommy bias, you know. So they try to be as they try to make things as easy for her as they can. So she still made me go there to pick my son up. But she said, well, you go to pick him up or drop him off. You don't get out the car. Your son can walk through the car, you know, unassisted, and they must stay in the house. But do you think that they followed that? No. But, you know, and then guys have this little sense inside of them. They get kind of stupid when it comes to women for some reason, you know. They look past common sense. They look past truth. They look past facts. And they got to, if you excuse my expression here, it's one that we say in the ghetto here, kind of slang, is that they get this Captain Favor hole feeling all of a sudden, you know. They feel they got to be the champion for this woman, and they're going to show this guy, you know. And they put themselves in a place that they had no business being, see. And I know what her child's father was going through, because I'm going through it myself right now. And it takes a lot for me to bite my tongue, because I'm not really one of those guys, you know. When I'm showing you respect and I'm being as respectable as I can, and sometimes I feel like I only have to show you respect when it comes to my child, you know. And I kind of feel what Mike is saying, is that you go to court and hear some strangers telling you about what you're going to do and when you're going to see your kid, you know, when you go up into a court. Couldn't no stranger on the street come and tell me that, you know. Now without getting the teeth knocked out, you know. And why do we as parents sit up here, and I really ain't want to do that either. I've been in trouble for that before, too, and a lot of judges really don't like me, but I've toned it down a little bit. So I've been learning to whoop them with the motions and the pleadings. But,
This
child, that guy is totally out of pocket, and he had no business even being in the vicinity, you know.
Right.
That's just for me on the outside looking in, but from what information I have. But still, if he's lucky he didn't get killed, because those are some of the most highly charged and most emotional situations that you can get, and to try to involve yourself in something like that is crazy. So,
well, you've got to just leave. You know, what we've got to do is we've got to say, look, both of you are parents to the child. Both of you are going to remain parents to this child. And the state has an obligation to the kids to rise above the parents' conflict. You know, I mean, I think it would be very interesting that if you that every time you had situations like this, you said to the parents, "Okay, now you got to go to classes 3 times a week for the next 6 weeks to learn how to get along." And every time they did that, they just got another 6 weeks of 3 times a week of going to classes. And eventually, most of them are going to wake up and go, "We're tired of going to these court-ordered classes 3 times a week for 6 weeks at a time." You know, and they'll learn to get along, because they just don't want to be doing that same stupid thing all the time. I think it'd take feuding parents like those two. And I tell you, it's amazing how you continue to get bad behavior if bad behavior is rewarded. And so,
right.
So I see all the time interference with access where, and it's really interesting, I've had attorneys that will say, you know, when access interference is being handled as a criminal matter, and the judge looks at a parent that's doing that and says, "If you're back here again," the judge will say, "I am sentencing you to 30 days in jail for this behavior. I am suspending the sentence for 1 year. If you're back here within that year for the same kind of thing, you're going to jail." Where on the civil side, the judge will come in and the judge will lecture the parent about how you shouldn't do that. And that's all there is. There's some little lecture. And the attorneys that deal with this, they'll tell you that when you're in a criminal contempt situation for visitation interference and a judge tells a parent that if you do it again, you're going to jail, it's completely different than when a judge just says, oh, you know, that's a bad thing, don't do it again. In the criminal side, you don't see those parents again because they know they're going to jail if they keep doing it. But in the civil side, where there's never any consequence for the action, it just happens over and over and over and over again. And that's what's going on in this, you know, in this particular situation. You got people behaving.
Well, what I would like to do at this point before we close out the show, because while you were finding all the statistics for us, Michael, I was discussing with General his objectives for 2013. I'd like for you to share with us before we close out the show what your objectives for your organization are. And I would like to commit to us having these shows on a quarterly basis, because I think once or twice a year for us to talk is really not enough, especially when when it's clear there's so many reforms that really need to be made, and we need as much support on behalf of what's in the best interest of the children and the family unit, even though the family unit lives on opposite sides of the street now. So if you could just share with us what your organization's objectives are for 2013.
Well, by and large, our organization is to continue to support the organizations that we are affiliated with and that have affiliated with ACSC to work on these issues in the state level. So I'll continue to be involved and support Illinois Fathers as we work to pass these laws in the state of Illinois, and we'll do that around the country. For instance, today was the first meeting of the Family Law Study Committee for the state of South Carolina to begin to act on and expand some of the reform legislation that was enacted there during 2012. On a very positive note, in North Dakota, one county in North Dakota, actually the citizens were able to vote on November 6th on a binding referendum, on a binding ballot initiative, to have equal shared parenting be the law of the land for the courts in that county. And that was enacted by the voters in the county. So it's the first place we have in the United States where the citizens have voted and said, yes, we want equally shared parenting to be the norm in our county. Now the legal profession is attempting to challenge that. So we're going to fight that. We're going to fight that battle. The citizens have spoken. They've said children should have a full and equal relationship with both parents. We want to see that law stays on the books. We'll be doing that. Earlier this year, we actually had a shared parenting bill, a bill that would give a minimum of 35% time to both parents, actually passed the Senate and the House in the state of Minnesota, and it went to the governor's desk for signature, and the governor vetoed the bill. We're going to do it again this year and work with our folks at the Center for Parental Responsibility there to get that legislation passed again and make sure the governor signs it, because the people spoke through the legislative body, said we want more kids to have more time with both parents, and the governor vetoed that legislation. He acted directly against what we know is in the best interest of children and parents. And in fact, the legislature on the House side there had passed an initial bill that gave both parents a minimum of 45.1% time. They actually dealt with 90% of the custody time right off the bat, and the lawyers on the Senate side wouldn't agree, so the compromise was 35% time to each parent, and then the governor turned around and listened to, you know, not to the people, but listened to the lawyers and vetoed that legislation. So we're just going to keep bringing it all over the country. We will continue judicial education efforts. Those are very productive. We are seeing judges award more shared parenting as they become more aware of what the social science research says. We will continue to bring forward the social science research and encourage and facilitate the distribution of that research. And then we will also continue to make available you know, material to help people who are individually involved in the system. I want to tell your listeners and once again that they can go to acfc.org at the very bottom of the homepage, go to Shared Parenting Resources, and there's a 168-page manual there that will help them understand the family law system. There's a 13-page paper there that's specifically about child support. There's another one that's 15, 16 pages about how we got to where we got to today in family law. People need to understand how this system developed and what the influences are on the system and why it works the way it does. And I think that, and I'm a great believer that in education. And that's what we'll be spending a lot of time in the upcoming year, educating the public, educating legislators, educating judges, basically educating anybody that will listen. And that's what we're doing. We're going to keep bringing legislation, keep encouraging improvement in the family law arena, and we'll get there. You know, every year we see. General, every year we see more progress, don't we? I mean, it took us 2 years to get the Watkins. It took us. We started the Watkins bill, General. What was it, in 2010? And it took us.
It was January of 2011. So,
well, it was 2010 that you and I sat down with the Watkins family.
The Watkins, yeah.
December of 2010, we sat down in Springfield at the Panera Bread. And we said, hey, would you be interested if we worked and brought legislation? And they said, yep, we'd really like to see some. Steve Watkins was murdered by his ex-wife's grandmother when he went to pick up his child for visitation, and he was shot and killed by the grandmother of his ex-wife. And so we went to work on this bill, started in 2010, started over a cup of coffee in a sandwich shop. And 2 years later, there's a fantastic visitation interference bill in Illinois. That's the way it happens. It happens because people, care and get involved and get active. And so, you know, we're also going to train people this year. And spend a lot of time training people on how they can, you know, Mike McCormick can't do this, right? General Parker can't. General Parker's a great guy. He doesn't do it alone. I don't do it alone.
No.
We do it by getting together and acting together. This is the great part of our society is that we can do this. You know, citizens can see a problem, they can come together, and they can get it addressed. And I think that this area of family law is wide open to it. So,
I would also like to be involved in the future with assisting in that, especially in the areas of mediation and the parents coming to a common place of understanding that their child or their children are the focus. And they shouldn't lose sight of that.
Yep.
And I don't think that happens enough here in New York City. That's why that number is so high.
Well,
and
you know how I think you can help us out very much, Bree, with your radio show, and I think you got a website with your blog spot there. Reach out to people because I'm in Illinois, I can help you out in New York and vice versa. So, Mike sent me something the other night. There was some legislation they were trying to get voted in Ohio the other day. And I got people that I knew here, and I knew some legislators there, you know. And I sent a letter that I'm going to let them know all these organizations that are in support of child support reform or something, Mike? Or was it the...
It was just bad child support legislation. The state of Child Support Enforcement Agency was trying to quickly move some legislation through that would be harmful to people paying child support, and I always kind of liken it, you know, these child support agencies are so powerful, and I always look at it like when the Romans used to throw the Christians to the lions, there was really no doubt about the outcome. but nobody thought it was necessary to create more laws to protect the lions. And it's really like that with respect to child support enforcement. These agencies are very, very powerful, yet they're always seeking new legislation to expand their power and to cause more problems for the citizens. And we really don't need to do that. What we need to do is actually stop some of the harmful impact that they're having. And I'm the first person to say that, you know, parents need to support their children, but we don't need to take and throw poor people into jail. That doesn't make any sense. You know, we don't.
No,
need
it
to,
does not.
You know, debtor's prison doesn't help any of us.
And you'll be interested to both know on a closing note that I've been contacted by two attorneys who are Facebook friends of mine that are family court attorneys and family law attorneys, and they are very interested in having future dialogue with you, the panel. So we're going to try to arrange something, hopefully, in the beginning or second week, maybe in January, if you gentlemen are both available, because now we're going to bring some additional dynamic or perspective into this conversation. I'm quite sure it'll be quite interesting.
Oh, I'm telling you, there are some really neat things going on. I can't wait to have that conversation. You know, we have a wonderful there was actually a lawsuit filed in federal court last month against the State Bar Association to stop them from lobbying, using members' money to lobby legislation that is anti in the interest of citizens. Family law.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about that in our future show. All the listeners should look for that, hopefully in the beginning, the first or second week in January. I want to thank Michael McCormick and General Parker for participating in this much needed and continuing conversation about child custody and support. Is it friend or foe? And are we on the fence about that, gentlemen, or is it clear what it is?
Oh, you know what? I tell you what. There's an old saying that the largest room in the world is the room for self improvement, and I just think the same thing about family law. Is that the room for improvement in family law is just tremendous, and I frankly find it very gratifying and exciting to actually be in a position to be able to help bring about those improvements. And there are a lot of folks that even people within the system that know that the system can be much better than what it is today. And I'm really excited by what the opportunities that are in front of us. So thanks so much for providing a forum and for using.
And I will continue to, because this is something that I feel equally passionate about. I shared my own story, because of separation with my child's father, with my son's father, and also being a child of divorce, at a very early age. So I unfortunately got a chance to be a part of this situation and these dynamics over a period of many years. And I don't want a child or children to go through what I've gone through or what I watched my son for, thank God, a short period of time, because eventually his father and I, we got it, that he was the most important dynamic, and we put him first. And he's doing great as a result of that. And he's benefiting from us coming to a better understanding. And thank God. So I just want to help provide that forum so that people can become more educated, as you said, Mike, in general, and understand the importance of putting children first. So, gentlemen, thank you again for participating in this dialogue. I really appreciate it. I appreciate all the time that you've given to the Bree Life Radio Show. You're both family members, and we want you to come back in a few weeks so that we can have that next interesting conversation with the two lawyers that was listening in. So we'll set that up. But thank you again, and I want to most of all thank all our listeners and remind them that they can tune into the Bree Life Radio Show tomorrow at 9 p.m. for Freestyle Thursdays. You know that's what we do best. peace and blessings. I love you all on purpose. Take care and God bless. Good night.
God bless. Good night.
Good night.
Take care.